deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan. It's the Grace and Paul Podcast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution.
Hello!
All right.
I always, you know.
Close enough. So I have in the text that I'm reading, I have like markings for sound effects.
Yeah.
Because I want to do a thing.
You want to do a thing?
I want to like do it up with like sound effects of deep woods and like crickets and, you know,
all
does
the
moon make a, does the full moon make a sound? I guess
that
that's
was it.
That's it.
That was the sound.
Yeah. So, and then coyotes and wolves or whatnot, just to convey the idea. So this is our pathetic little podcast for Easter weekend. So
Easter 2018 crushed it.
This is Easter Fool's Day. Happy Easter Fool's Day, everyone.
Really feels like it.
Here's why we're the Easter Fools.
So yeah, it started last week. Early in the week, I was feeling a little bit sick, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'll be better in like 48 hours. I usually am. Yeah, no. Day three, the sweats began. So I'm finally better, like today, Easter Sunday, I'm finally better myself.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I could go out in public. It's not.
Yeah.
Not yet. But at this point, you've been sick.
Slightly.
Sam's been sick and is starting to recover. Joshua got sick. Pippin's just starting. Veronica hasn't said anything, but I think she's taking the opportunity to hide and sleep.
She's getting a lot of extra sleep. So, yeah, so we don't know exactly what this is, whether...
Oh, Eleanor's down.
Eleanor's down.
Yeah, and, so...
Yeah, so we... I should just put it... To put it in context, Easter for us, for our family, is a much bigger celebration than Christmas.
Yes.
And we actually look forward to it, and we sometimes do the vigil mass, and mm-hmm. we...
We usually start on Holy Thursday.
Yeah.
With the foot washing.
Yeah.
And then Good Friday.
Yeah. So it's a multi-day celebration.
Yeah.
And we also try and do a big meal and have everyone within earshot, you know.
Come on over.
Yeah.
And have a bite.
But no, it was just all falling apart this week.
Right.
And it's really disappointing because you and I have been doing Easter masses, attending Easter masses together since before we were married.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think we've ever missed
one. We've never missed one. This is the first one we've missed.
Right.
Yeah. It's... Now, Easter happens without us.
Easter happens without us.
It's. I don't mean to like make it all about me.
No, but it's not,
but
it's not just
not
us, too. I mean,
right.
It's also...
My sister-in-law was planning to come for
right.
Easter dinner.
It's a family thing
and
a celebration with the kids.
Right.
And I was considering inviting some other friends,
right.
but it was clear that things weren't, you know, at best we'd have kind of a minimal, like...
A minimal display, a minimal showing.
And we might be all, at worst, we'd all be highly contagious.
Exactly. So I had to call off all the guests yesterday and just, yeah, and I kept holding out hope, but hey, you know what? I'm the only one sick. Maybe we'll just miss, like, Holy Thursday and Friday. And then I'll be better Saturday,
right.
and we can all go on Sunday. And it's all fine. It'll all work out. But then, like, kids just started dropping like flies.
We don't really know exactly what this is. I was not feeling bad enough last week during the week to not go into work.
Right.
And I had a flu shot around December,
mm-hmm.
Around Christmas. So my symptoms, whatever... They are, for me, I could not really clearly distinguish them from this thing I've had for months and months, right?
Oh, right.
This respiratory thing, which I'm seeing a doctor for. So I couldn't really distinguish clearly. It seemed like maybe I was getting feverish again, but I had this like, because like for months last fall,
mm-hmm.
I had a mild fever every day, and I had this terrible post-nasal drip and this stuff, and that wasn't a virus per se. That was like a chest infection that was just in for the long haul.
Long haul, yeah.
This may be a flu virus.
It might be. It's unclear.
We're not 100% sure. It has the fever, the exhaustion, and the joint aches, the joint pain.
Right.
And I think I had something like it last summer.
Yeah.
It's not a norovirus. It's not a digestive thing.
Nope.
At least not so far.
Although you do kind of lose your appetite.
Well, that happens with a bad cold, too, sometimes.
You just kind of lose your appetite. You're just not interested. Like, I would frequently just end up inadvertently fasting all day.
Yeah.
And then, I'd hit some soup, and I'd be like, yeah, I'm all about this.
Yeah, if the soup is... When your husband brought you soup, you're like, oh, I could eat that.
I could eat that.
Yeah.
I could eat all of that. So,
yeah, so I haven't been that hungry either, but, I could stand to lose a couple pounds. But
So the idea of a huge feast was really like,
not appealing.
Not even appealing.
Yeah.
So we have some, I have some mild concern for Eleanor, so I'm keeping an eye on her.
Eleanor is the one who's got it bad as like a respiratory infection.
Right. So she's peeing and she's pooping.
But we're watching her closely because thing is, if she does get something bad, we're not just going to take her to urgent care. We have to take her to Mott.
Right, to a children's center. Right.
Well, to her children's hospital, because she has what they call a complex congenital heart defect and surgical scars and
all this stuff.
Prostheses.
So, yes, we want to take her someplace where they know what's going on.
Right.
Or at least know the history.
Right. So if her fever spikes or if she gets real lethargic or seems to be not,
I mean, she's perky, tired. She's tired.
She's sleeping it off. But, yeah. But
it's like there's a turn for the worse.
There's sort of a line we feel like we can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where a child just doesn't look well.
If she's coughing and complaining, actively complaining, that's a sign of health. But if she gets really sluggish
that you can't even complain to you, right?
Then that's a danger.
That's actually dangerous. Dangerous. But no, peeing, pooping, eating still.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's still nursing frequently. And those are all good signs. So I'm not terribly concerned, but we are watching.
She's the one who's young enough that I'm concerned about her health and her symptoms are severe enough. The others are just like, they all covered with snot and sleeping all the time. But they're not, none of them are bad enough that I'm worried about their
safety. Like, I'm terribly concerned. No. I'm making them tea and soup. But
We're making sure everyone is hydrated and, eating some calories, but mostly the hydration.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's like what we've been doing for Easter.
That's what we've been doing for Easter. And
yay.
I have the day off work tomorrow because I'm going to Beaumont Hospital.
Check out your chest thing.
To check out my, to have some tests done on my lung function.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my irritability of my respiratory system.
Right.
And see if what the doctor recommends for trying to manage this and whether he thinks it's related to this genetic disorder
that we talked about. Yeah.
Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, like the carrier form.
So I always knew you were an alpha male.
I am an alpha male.
I've always done it.
Anyway, just recently, if you're following along, we talked about this a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently got my test results and learned that I do have the carrier form of this this genetic disorder. I have like the MZ variant of the gene, which means that my alpha 1 is reduced, but not nothing.
Mm-hmm.
People with the severe version wind up oftentimes later in life having severe disease from it and may need a lung and or liver transplant. And I shouldn't need that, but the MZ form is associated with higher risk of COPD,
mm-hmm.
chronic bronchitis, they used to call it, things like that.
Right.
And that's kind of what I've had. So figuring out how to reduce that and treat the symptoms.
Yeah. So maybe we'll get
some news. And I was debating whether, am I sick enough that I should cancel so I don't go there with a flu virus?
Right.
But I don't think I am.
Right. No, I don't think I am. I don't think you are either.
So,
and I'm not anymore.
So, yeah, anyway. So, we're not going to do a full-blown topic today.
No, we're just here to, mark the day and tell you we love you.
I wanted to run through a little bit of what we've been up to.
Sure, sounds good.
So, last Tuesday, we went to a talk at Mason Hall on Central Campus, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Professor Elizabeth Anderson, her topic was private governments in the workplace.
Yeah. Do we have the name of her book down there?
I think her book is Private Government.
Oh, Private Government. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And I'll try and remember to put a link into it.
For the book.
For a link from the show notes. So what she was talking about is how in a workplace we have this system that we consider to be liberating, usually, and fair.
You get a check.
And fair.
Yeah.
You know, and all these things under capitalism, but which, in her analysis, comprises a kind of a unique form of government that the state allows employers to have over employees.
Right. And a private rather than public form of government.
Right. And she doesn't, the analysis was quite interesting. She doesn't mean it just strictly in terms of public versus private sector. It's about this employee-employer relationship where it has more to do with the fact that employees are at will and, you know.
Oh, can I do this part?
You want to do this part?
Yeah.
I don't have all my notes with me.
No, but I thought the most interesting part of her talk.
Her analysis, yeah.
Yeah, hands down.
She's a philosophy professor, right. So it was slightly abstract.
But it's
and maybe
really,
a little, very insightful though, maybe a little hard to follow, but then do your thing and then I've got my version of the analogy.
But like if you get it,
yeah.
Like this is a really big piece of information.
Okay, do it.
So she went at pains to say, people think of public versus private, like this is the private sector, this is public because it's the government.
No.
Public is what is public to you, what is open to
your scrutiny,
you're a stakeholder in it, and you have some standing to say something.
Yes.
Right? Now, if you have no standing to say something, it's not open to your scrutiny, it's private to you.
Yes.
So this is about your position with regards to something else.
Uh-huh.
So if there's a government that controls you in some sphere.
Yes.
And you have no standing to make claims on this government.
She used that phrase a lot. What's your standing
with respect to this
institution?
Right. Yeah. You have no authority.
Yep. Authority.
And they can sanction you.
Yep.
And you can't appeal or, you know, you have no rights to do anything about that.
Uh-huh.
That government is private to you.
Yeah.
So this could be any number of places or realms. And there are lots of things that are private to you, and you know you don't care because it doesn't affect your life in some way.
Right. But this is one you're.
This is one you're actually subject to.
You're subject to, and you can't. You know, it's all this. Well, why don't you just leave? You know, your job or whatnot. Well, she demolished that. And
no,
that's easy to demolish. Right.
She pushes that aside. But that's what she's getting at when she says that the workplace is actually a private government that isn't in de facto a dictatorship.
Yes.
It's a de facto dictatorship, and it's a private dictatorship.
Right.
So even some dictatorships are public, and people can leave and so on.
Right.
But they're still dictatorships. But those public dictatorships are better still because they're public and not just private at the will of the dictator.
Right. So as in a private government in the form of a privately held employer that runs your life in some ways can be in fact much more pernicious than a dictatorial government.
Yes, yes.
And much more harmful to your health and your safety and your interests.
Yes.
I think of it in terms of image that kept popping into my head as far as private government and whatnot is that it's a question of literally who is accountable to you. So in a public democratic government, your leaders are accountable to you, and you have they actually, you know, that's why they call it representative democracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a representative, you have someone to call.
Mm-hmm.
In a workplace like this, so in that kind of situation, they have to be looking down. Your leaders have to be looking down down the hierarchy at the grassroots, theoretically at least they do.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, the way it really works with funding and Citizens United and all that and campaign finance,
mm-hmm.
you can pretty much draw your conclusions as to where they really spend their time looking to.
Yeah.
You know, but in this kind of workplace environment, your boss is looking up.
Right.
Up the hierarchy.
Yeah, it's largely unconcerned with.
Yes, and if you, and then, you know, if you bring a concern to human resources, say, their concern is automatically not necessarily designed for your interests.
Right. No, automatically their interest is not you.
Right. So they're not, so everyone's looking up the hierarchy and not down the hierarchy.
Right.
So so they're punching down, right, in comedy terms.
Right.
And I'm also reminded there was sort of a famous cartoon piece of poster art where, like, if you're on top, you know, there's a, like a bunch of birds on levels on perches, right? Mm-hmm. If you're on top, things look pretty good. If you're at the bottom, you look up and all you see are assholes.
Right? Oh, I see everywhere.
They're all pooping on each other.
All pooping on each
other. And the ones at the bottom are completely encased in bird poop.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It's
at the bottom of the
It's lungs. Funny. Anyway.
Sad and funny. Well, actually, what really left off...
The screen?
The screen to me.
She did a PowerPoint, right. Of course.
Let's say the page, but it wasn't a page. Was that given her definition? We live in and have lived in a totalitarian government for a long time, which I've been saying. But philosophically speaking, that's just a fact. We have a veneer.
Yes. Yeah.
A veneer of plausible deniability.
Right.
But you know, if it's not accountable to me, you know, and I don't have any standing to change anything, you know, that's actually a private government.
Right.
And that's where we already are with our literal government that we think of as public.
Right. She then had a bunch of sort of horrific examples. For example,
In the workplace.
Yeah. For example, slaughterhouse workers that aren't allowed to take a break to urinate because they're not required to give this to their employees.
And they actually expect them to just wear diapers.
Yeah. That's one example. Then there's garment workers and their wages, sweatshop conditions. You know, she had a number of examples. And if you're, you know, into labor issues, these are not new.
It's not news, no.
But she's just highlighting them. Mm-hmm. And then her remedies. Yeah, that's her little baby with her hacking cough.
Miserable little baby. Yeah.
The remedies part talked about how do you bring more workplace or democracy to the workplace.
Yes.
And that's where things get difficult and interesting. Because without, you know, with union rights going unenforced, you know, and your rights to organize very frequently being punished with no one taking the side of the workers to defend your right to organize, you know, there's really only so much you can do. The totalitarianism is bad.
Yes. And it's really bad, especially in the United States, where our labor law has no teeth to begin with, and then that toothless labor law is unenforced.
It's unenforced.
Right.
And so she talked about, she used a phrase that I've heard before in management, but it's interesting to hear it used in a political and philosophical sense, path dependencies, where, you know, once a field has been plowed in a particular direction, it's, you know, easy to move things this way. It's very hard to rip up and start from scratch to really change structures. I think of it as there are pretty hard boundaries on just how far a system will allow itself to be changed by working within the system.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so anyway.
The system defends itself.
System defends itself, and there's a lot of money involved. And so, you know, I took pages of notes and all this, and, you know, I feel fortunate to be in a workplace myself that is a small group, largely working with people that I like quite a bit. There's no one in our group or our team who I would call, like, you know, one of these horrible coworkers or something. There's no one like that. And I feel pretty strongly that if we did wind up with someone who everyone couldn't stand, that we would get rid of that person, you know, it would in order to keep it from being a toxic workplace.
But what if
workplace.
That person was the boss, though?
Well, I'm fortunate that I get along pretty well with my boss, but there is no you know, this is not a worker-owned cooperative.
Nope.
It's not a democratic workplace.
Nope.
And so, you know, I have to make choices that align with what my boss would like me to do. Let's put it that way.
Indeed. Indeed. It's not a worker-owned cooperative. And what was the other one that she has a remedy? It was like labor unions, worker-owned cooperatives, and there was a third thing.
Oh.
I want to say codependency, but that was
it's
like...
It's not codependency. It's not co-management, but...
There was a co-word, and I'm...
I'm sorry. It's in my written notes.
And yeah, I'm blanking on the co-word, and I... Yeah.
But basically, it puts labor... And this works better, actually, for companies with taller hierarchies, right?
Puts labor on the board.
It puts labor on the board. It puts the union in the boardroom. Mm-hmm. It makes... it insists that labor is representative at all levels of decision-making.
Yeah. Which, you know, that's nice.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to dismiss that.
She was suggesting that this was something that really assisted, improved workplace quality, you know, for the workers.
She actually seemed to assert that it was the best option.
That it was the best option given that with all the resistance and path dependency and structural barriers, that it was very difficult to try and figure out how to turn an existing workplace into a real
worker-owned cooperative,
a real democratic institution,
and well, into a democratically owned worker-owned cooperative.
Yeah,
and I don't know. The dismissals I hear of worker-owned cooperatives are always
Well, that can't possibly work.
Yeah, like they're very light on facts.
No, it's just a light weight. It's like a pink fluffy defense of capitalism, right?
Right, right. So which makes me immediately suspicious, and that's the reason I recall it as codependency, right? Of the asserted best option.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that worker-owned cooperatives are really
the best option.
The best option.
Yeah. What was it? Is it Bob's Red Mill?
Bob's Red Mill just converted to a worker-owned cooperative.
Where he actually, when Bob...
Decided to retire.
If indeed he was named Bob.
His name's Bob.
When Bob retired, he basically gave the company to his employees.
Sold it.
He sold it to them.
He sold it to them at a price they could afford.
And so
he gets a retirement and they get the company.
And it's now literally a worker-owned cooperative.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's pretty intense and seems kind of radical for a company that
it really is.
Makes oatmeal.
Well, no, it makes oatmeal. And actually, you see that as soon as it became worker-owned,
yeah,
suddenly, did you notice their product line diversified?
The gluten-free stuff whatnot.
Their product line dramatically diversified as soon as it became worker-owned. Because, you know, he had his vision and this thing he was doing. He was doing that thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it transferred into employee ownership. And they're like, hey, there's lots of places we could take this.
I guess, okay, so I do believe that a worker-owned, you know, democratically run cooperative really is the best solution. But if we sort of hold to that and say this is what has to happen, mm-hmm. then you're just going to wind up with a lot of, I don't know, co-op washing kind of stuff happening where companies will like create like a light and fluffy version of this
where it's like putting out a
suggestion box and saying great, now we're democratic, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to see that. I actually want to see the employees own the company.
You would like to see, but I think that's a more realistic option in most companies for companies starting now, you know, starting up from the ground up.
I think there are two places where it's possible.
Yeah.
I think companies starting from the ground up can do it from the get-go.
From the get-go.
Or
and then they build up a whole culture and
non-publicly traded companies with a strong founder.
Yes.
That individual can make that decision.
And it's actually
the best decision for the individual. Because he or she gets a retirement, and a comfortable retirement at that,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they know it's in good hands.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because frankly, you remember that there was a car place around here that
Oh, Howard Cooper.
Yeah. The guy retired, right?
Yeah.
And instead of selling it to his employees, motherfucker sold it to another dealership. And then
the dealership took over.
Took over. And these people are like, you could actually hear them saying, "What a great, we have a new master. How wonderful." Yeah. Like, it was so sick reading this article.
Yeah.
And so, but that was the owners.
Did he fire everyone?
No, he didn't fire everyone. But they, that was the thing. The owner was negotiating to make sure that he wasn't going to fire everyone, that everyone would keep their jobs. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, don't ship anyone downriver.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, you can't beat them.
Yeah.
You got to be nice to them. All right? All right, now you can have them. They're yours.
Well,
it was really, really sick and depraved. And now here's the thing. The reason he went for that is he wanted a retirement.
I see.
He wanted to sell it and get something
for it. And get something out of it.
For his retirement and then move on.
A significant
thing. And he never, you know, selling it to the employees was not on the radar, not a mechanism, not anything the state or any infrastructure prepared for him. And in fact, in the state of Michigan, if you want to start a cooperative, you have to found a corporation and then insert cooperative language in your bylaws. But there's actually no cooperative form for you to file
to start out with
the state. Right? So those are, I think it's bifurcated, where you can start a cooperative and you could take over from a founder and convert it. Because that's, I mean, that's how, was it? Johnny Selected Seeds, High Mowing Seeds, all these really great companies. Oh, King Arthur Flour.
Yeah.
All of these places are employee owned and great places to work.
Yeah.
Honestly. Great products. Happy to do business with them. I think they either started employee owned, were started by employees who invested, or they were buyouts from a founder.
Interesting. Okay.
So I think that that could happen.
It can happen. I can so, but part of her point was that it's the state that allows these sort of this version of private government to flourish.
Encourages.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. it creates the same way that you know the quote free market is a very carefully planned and organized. You
know, want it.
That's considered communism to talk about a planned economy, but that's exactly what we have.
Right.
You know. A planned economy where we create a market and put very clear limits and boundaries and controls on the market.
Right.
And workplaces are like that.
Right.
So, anyway.
It was interesting.
It was a good talk.
Mm-hmm.
You were.
I'm interested in reading the book.
Yeah, I think we're gonna track down a copy of the book. You were a little peaked.
Yeah.
You were a little sick.
I was not my best. I had lots of questions, but my voice was so croaky I didn't even want to try to talk.
Yeah. There was a good Q&A session afterwards.
Q&A session was as long as the presentation.
Which was nice that she arranged the woman running it.
Arranged for the space.
She arranged, left enough time and hung out with us long enough until everyone basically got tired of it.
Right.
So... Mm-hmm. So that was good. And I just want to say this was organized, arranged under the auspices of the Huron Valley DSA. Democratic Socialists of America.
We're not actually an organizing arm of the DSA, just to be clear.
We're not. I don't feel entirely comfortable with everything they do and everything they stand for, but they are a big tent organization. I have not actually joined yet. Mm-hmm. I see them more as social democrats than as democratic socialists, even though they call themselves the other.
Right.
And what I mean by that is their version. It's like Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic. Which one does he call himself?
I think he calls himself a social democrat. I think. I always get confused.
No, I shouldn't have asked you if I didn't know. Because
Now
I can't,
you can't tell
if you're right or not.
Right.
Anyway, Bernie Sanders is a very light socialist, right?
Like super light.
He's considered, the rhetoric I hear now on Twitter and the phrases people starting to use, they refer to him as a hard left populist.
Which is not true.
And the idea that he's hard left is comical. It's just, it belies a complete misunderstanding of all of American political history and European political history.
Like yeah. It belies a fundamental misunderstanding of the words.
Yeah.
But a clear perspective of the Overton window.
Yeah. So I think Social Democrat to me is more towards the Democrat side, that is more centrist or
right.
And Democratic Socialist is you start out as a socialist and you apply, you make some modifications to make yourself democratic. Rather than vice versa.
Straight up socialist.
So the DSA to me is more social democrat in that they're more soft socialist.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of folks I know and respect and follow who are further to the left of the DSA platform.
Yeah.
As am I believe. But there's, strictly speaking, there's not that clear a DSA platform. It's more about organizing principles for issues, and a big tent. So anyway, we're interested in the DSA insofar as what they're doing, what they're organizing is.
What's your praxis?
What's their praxis?
Yeah.
So this was part of their praxis.
Having a conversation.
Yes. Okay, so we'll be looking into this Professor Anderson's book, and
hopefully a review will be coming.
And she mentioned that she does podcasts, so maybe we'll get her.
Maybe we'll get her
on the show here,
and I can ask her my questions now that I have my voice back.
See, I thought this was going to be a really brief mention about the thing we went to.
Here we are.
But then you got into it and you were waving your, people can't see you, but you were waving your arms
Mr.
and
Carter.
Practically standing out of your chair, like your eyes were all lit up and, animated and like, oh, okay. She's got a thing to say. Yeah. This is what always happens, folks. Okay. I have read a little more of this book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President.
I'm sorry.
By Bandy X. Lee et al.
That's bound to happen.
And a few comments. So a few thoughts about the book. The first is that it's not a book, right?
Right. Yeah.
And what I mean by that is it's not a monograph. It's a series of essays that were contributed. The authors, we mentioned last time, they are all constrained by the Goldwater Rule in that if they are psychiatrists, they're not allowed to offer some official diagnosis of a public figure whom they have not treated.
Right.
And if they had treated, they would be bound by confidentiality. Right. So... So they don't really offer a diagnosis.
Yeah.
The book, it's well padded, tall line spacing, and pages of footnotes after each chapter.
Hey, I'm well padded. Come on.
So it's a pretty quick read. You want a woman to be well padded, but not so much a book. At least I do.
Okay.
Anyway.
Fair enough.
I guess that's a matter of taste. But the chapters so far are more interesting for what they say that isn't about 45. That's what I found.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I can see that.
First chapter talks about time perspective theory. I mentioned that last time. That was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I could think that it would be interesting to other people as well, not because it teaches you that much about time perspective theory, but that it introduces the concept of time perspective theory and in the context of this present hedonism notion.
Oh, right.
Which is maybe a useful construct for describing how certain people approach their lives. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Second chapter actually is about the history of the Nixon administration.
Hmm.
And it talks about narcissism. Hmm. If you hadn't taken several undergraduate courses on, abnormal psychology, or as they call it, exceptional behavior, it would... Maybe if you didn't already know quite a bit about the history of the Nixon administration, it would perhaps be quite interesting.
Right.
I already had and did, and so it's like review.
Been there, done that.
The third chapter is by the ghostwriter of The Art of the Deal. Right. So I haven't read The Art of the Deal, but so he says things about Trump, about how free he is to lie and make up stuff, and everything is based on his self-aggrandizement and everything. And
right.
none of that was really surprising or new.
Yeah, no, it was.
So, anyway, like I said, it's kind of a slight book. If you are younger than me or less educated than me and spend less time reading about politics than I do, you're already, then you might find it interesting. There might be
new information for you.
Yeah. I'll skim some more and see if there are more chapters, because each chapter is a different author, a different article. Mm-hmm. See if there are chapters that have some insight. Right. But for the most part, I can't really recommend it as a book, and I don't think it's going to be like one of the defining documents of this era or whatnot.
You know? No, it was Craven. Honestly, it was Craven.
It was a bit of a money grab to release it right when they did, especially given that this president hadn't been in office long enough to really do anything.
Yeah.
So,
It's...
Go figure. A lot of books are written for money.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. It's hard to really feel like it's a big send up.
I want to mention another book that I have not done a full review of, but I keep reading at.
Yeah.
And I believe it's a book almost in the same vein, but I think it's much better.
Which one is it?
False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, edited by Liza Featherstone.
That actually seemed like it had more
meat. Point.
Well, it had more meat on it and actually made more sense. This seemed like...
Its existence makes more sense.
Makes more sense.
Right.
These are the people trying to talk folks who are ostensibly on the left, talk them down.
Yeah, this book was published before the election.
Published before the election and as fodder to contribute to the election.
To contribute to that debate over whether we really should be electing
Clinton.
Right. And they are it's a bright pink book, right? It's a relatively small book. And all the authors contributing to the collection consider themselves to be left feminists.
Be left feminists, right.
Yeah. Including there's at least one man on the
right. These are all left feminists talking to left feminists about left feminism. I think you get to do that.
Right. And they're and it's meatier in two senses. One is that it's quite polemical, obviously.
Yes, right.
And the other is because we have many, many years of Hillary Clinton's public life to draw on, her political public life.
Right, there's a lot more to talk about.
So when they talk about her bellicosity, right, her foreign policy.
They have events to point to.
You can talk about Honduras. You can talk about Libya. There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Right. Now, these are relatively short essays. This isn't a massive...
I was able to finish one.
Yeah. In the time, bits of time you
the
have
time
available.
Given to me.
Right. So these are not, this isn't, in depth, but it points at a lot of other material that's out there. Mm-hmm. And it's valuable to me in that regard.
Right.
Right. Because it refers to a lot of other material. It actually aligns better with my own sensibilities and with my approach to trying to be evidence-based in your thinking, So there are pieces about Hillary and the carceral state, the Hillary.
You know, more and, evidence.
Yeah, Hillary and the American foreign policy, her attitudes towards... Grace is standing up to hold rock the baby a little bit. We're going to wind up soon here. This is going to be a short show. But anyway.
The carceral state, Hillary Clinton.
The carceral state, the prison industrial complex, the drug war, and specific and race issues, right? And then, I'm less engaged in, there's a chapter on Hillary's approach to abortion rights, right? Mm-hmm. And I've just kind of disengaged from that issue.
Yeah.
I'm not making that my hot button issue either on one side or the other anymore because I don't think I can contribute anything useful there.
No, and actually as pro-life as I am, I don't think it's ever been my wedge issue for me personally or my...
Hasn't been your personal crusade, if you will.
Right, it's not my personal crusade. It's not my wedge issue. It's not how I...
Litmus test.
I don't litmus test on it, but yeah.
Yeah, Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, so let's see what notes I had. I wrote, there's a review and a discussion with the editor and the contributors in Current Affairs magazine, and I'll put a link to that. Margaret Corvid says, this is a quote from the book, this is a quote from one of the contributors to the book. In my own circles, I have a lot of liberal friends, people who are saying to vote for Hillary and are extremely excited about this. Representation is important to them. I think the focus on representation is even worse than nothing at all, because it closes out opportunities for us to say that feminism is about something more than representation. It's about systematic structural change that gives women from all areas, races, classes, and nationalities more opportunities to be safe, more opportunities to have a good life and have their human rights respected. And so you can talk about Hillary being the first woman as a major nominee, but besides her gender, nearly everything else is against women. And this is my comment from my blog. She's talking about what Grace calls the cynical abuse of identity politics.
Yeah.
Identity as a cudgel to force voters to fall in line because of her identities and the identitarian ideas she promotes, while her actual policies and records were completely discordant with those ideals. It's real, and people all across the political spectrum felt this way about Clinton. And so Democrats who didn't vote for her are blamed for Trump, but I still believe it makes more sense to blame Democrats who refused to nominate Sanders.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
To blame for Trump.
Right.
So there's a link to the publisher's page, and then I've not read the book front to back because it's more the kind of thing like I don't really want to finish the essay on abortion rights.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to read all the ones about the prison industrial complex and, you know, policing and foreign policy. And I've done that, you know. So I think of it as a resource to dip into. It's a source of critical ideas on Clinton and Clintonism and neoliberalism, organized roughly by issues. So I've been more interested in some of the contributions, less interested in others. I think they're all worth reading. In general, this book is more challenging, better grounded in matters of actual public record and policy, and a more worthy addition to the discourse than The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah. And they're very similar. But
yeah,
actually, I think it contributes something more of value.
Yeah.
It allows us to start opening our brains to think about how to do something better in the future.
Yeah. And it's one reason is that the people who are contributing it to it largely are not embedded in this sort of professional administrative class, and their thinking isn't limited to professional administrative frame where everything has to be within the system, and you can't even, it's pointless to even speculate outside that
the system,
frame.
Right. Well, whereas I feel like, first of all, it seems like gross misconduct for psychiatrists to speculate, right?
Yeah, they're not all psychiatrists, but.
And secondly, okay, now what?
Now what?
Right. Whereas I feel like that the now what is more answered in the faux feminism book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my comment, both books run the risk of dating badly, but I think False Choices makes a better case for relevance because the centrist feminist Democrat movement, aka Clintonism, isn't going away.
It's not going away.
It doesn't require Clinton.
No, it just keeps coming. Yeah. It's really sick.
Whether Trumpism is a coherent thing still, or will
ever be.
Not even.
Trumpism appears to be like a Tea Party redo.
Yeah.
Which will be like remixed and will continue to remix.
Maybe remixed endlessly. But as far as like, you know, what's the Trump doctrine, right? Well, nobody can put their finger on that because the doctrine is whatever he burped up after two Big Macs and two Filet-O-Fish that particular day, you know. What he just tweeted on the John is his doctrine.
Yeah.
You know, under the Cheney administration, George W. Bush had a doctrine.
Yes.
Right? That got called the Bush Doctrine. And it had to do with, you know, if there's even a remote percentage of, you know, of a threat to the United States, we must destroy the threat.
Destroy
the
extreme prejudice.
Yeah, that was the Cheney Doctrine, a.k.a. the Bush Doctrine. Mm-hmm. But Trump so far, you know, a narcissism and unpredictability don't amount to a school of thought or policy.
No. I mean, you can call it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it
and, the corporatism behind both the Republican and Democratic veneers is already the order of the day.
That's the order of the day. This is status quo.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So same, more of the same, guys, you know?
More of the same.
Same old song, just a different day.
Yep. So there we are. That was going to be, I think we went more than 30 minutes, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. But, you know, I feel complete.
You feel complete?
Yeah, I'm good.
I was throwing my hands up in the air. I was like, okay, I'm going to have to post that we can't get a show out today because everyone's sick. But I'm glad we took a moment. So we'll see if we can follow up with the ideas about private government. And I'm always interested in hearing a philosopher talk about politics because
it's a little more interesting. It's a lot more interesting, actually.
If it's a good philosopher, that person, not a Jordan Peterson, say, that person can actually break down the ideas and use words that have meaning.
Yeah.
And make you see something in a different light. And that's what this idea did. So.
Yeah. No, I'm always open to evidence.
Happy to have it.
Happy to have it.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everyone. And happy Easter Fool's Day.
We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube.